Produced by women about women, Powerful Women Let's Talk is a series of interviews with women who have helped shape our community and transform who we are and how we live.
Welcome to Powerful Women Let's Talk. I'm Shelley Irwin. Dr. Mira Jordan is a clinical psychologist. Her practice focused on supporting autistic individuals with traumatic brain injury. She serves as division president within the American Psychological Association, along with other regional and national board services. You bet. We'll ask her about her perfect pandemic getaway. So hello to you, Doctor. Is it Jordan?
I say it wrong half the time, but most of Terry's family says Jordan. Yeah.
Yes.
I say Jordan just to give him a hard time.
What is the life of a clinical neuropsychologist, and how did you get here?
That's a great question. You may know about me. It's not my first career, but I was an engineer before I was a psychologist. And I really liked solving problems, but I didn't feel like the problems that I got to solve as an engineer at that time were human-focused enough. And I really wanted to use my problem-solving skills in a way that more directly impacted people. I started looking around, and I even got accepted business school, and I couldn't decide if that would make my life better. I ended up going into psychology. And I started out being interested in older adults. And so I had taken some classes at Wayne State, and a nurse practitioner friend took me to meet some women in Detroit who were living in a nursing home, and they were 90, 100 years old, and they were telling these amazing stories. You know, some of them had direct experience of things like the Great Migration. And I thought that that was just really fantastic. And I got really curious about older adults who stay really engaged in things, and then older adults who have a hard time maintaining positivity. So I started interviewing at schools, and my embarrassing admission is that when I got to the University of Florida, where I went, is one of probably the best graduate programs in neuropsychology in the country. I interviewed with somebody who had been or would be the president of two of the three major organizations governing neuropsychology. What I told him was, I don't exactly understand what this neuropsychology thing is, but you work with interesting people and you ask interesting questions. So if you'd let me be a part of it, I would like to. And he did take that chance on me. And it was a really positive experience. So neuropsychologists are people, basically doctors who use tests of thinking skills. We help understand how people's brains develop for children. And we help understand how brains change as a result of injuries like traumatic brain injury. Mm. Our role varies from setting to setting, but we do things like help understand why there's a problem and then help understand what to do about it. So we help patients and their doctors with treatment planning, with evaluating whether treatments are helpful, with making sure that people are able to pursue their highest level of potential and really feel like they're chasing their dreams and pursuing their own wellness.
As obviously you did. You obviously are in the trenches with your patients, but also leading. Let's talk about your leadership interests, both regionally and nationally, and why this is so important.
Well, I really see it as a way to give back. And I reached a point in my career where I continue to try to give back in the small ways. My husband organized a cleanup of the park that's behind our house last year or the year before that. But I also feel that serving on boards and things like that are a really good opportunity to use some of my technical skills to help organizations that are doing good work. So locally, right now, I'm involved with ICUS, Life Enrichment Services, which runs Indian Trails Camp and some other services. And I got involved really because they do great work with some people who are very much in need of support, and they have a really unique passion for this community. And you know, that shows in the people who've worked with them for 10, 20 years or more. And then I have the opportunity. So the American Psychological Association is divided into divisions, and divisions are both areas for technical expertise and areas that are professional homes for people. And I'm a member of three of those divisions. One is for neuropsychology, one's for the psychology of women, and then the third one is for the psychology of sexual orientation and gender diversity. And in that third one, I just became the president for a year on Saturday. Mm. And so I've really enjoyed giving back to the field. It's an opportunity for me to help support researchers and new clinicians. It's an opportunity also for me as a professional home. So as a transgender person, it's an opportunity for me to make sure that our voices are represented in the research that's being done and the way that people think about clinical work. And if it's a longer version of that story is that when I was in grad school, I spent a lot of time at a camp for kids with serious illnesses that is part of a camp system that Paul Newman created. Mm-hmm. And I spent really a ridiculous amount of time looking back there. But I did it because I was scared of kids. I originally didn't want to work with kids. I didn't like them. But I wanted to get some experience and some exposure. And what I found was that when I spent time with kids, when they weren't focused on being sick, when they were focused on having fun, I learned some things I didn't expect. These children really never wanted my sympathy. They wanted me to be there with them and have fun with them. And we had some of the most memorable experiences of my life. In that kind of way, when it comes to LGBT psychology, what I tell people is that a lot of even the psychologists and physicians who work with our communities, they don't know very many LGBT people and they don't know what happy LGBT people look like. And so it's important to me that we're visible and that we're communicating the kinds of lives that we can live if people let us.
And let's expand on that. What's it take to find one's own voice, to own your own voice?
Well, I think that the first thing I would say about that is it's evolving. I don't think that I was the same person I was 5 years ago or 10 or 20 years ago. And I don't think that I'll be the same person in 10 or 20 years. You know, I think sometimes people talk about even like purity testing, like in the political environment, where we go back and look at decisions a politician made in the 60s. And I did embarrassing things in the 2000s, you know, that I'm mortified that I did those things. And I don't mind discussing my mistakes, but I also want to emphasize that I learned from them and I try to be a better person, but also a better person who will make mistakes in the future too. So I think that finding your voice is an evolving process. Mm-hmm. It's a constant investment. As psychologists, we say that people construct their identities. There's no objective memory of the past. We don't walk around with camcorders or GoPros, you know, mounted to ourselves so that we can go back and look at those events. And even if we did, the camera would be pointed in the direction that we were looking in mm-hmm. and would be paying attention to the things that we were paying attention to at the time. So we all take our past and we interpret it based on our idea of meaning, and we construct the idea of who we are and we look to the future. And I think of all of those things as active processes. So when I think about my voice, the more that I invest in critically thinking about my past and critically thinking about the relationships I have with other people today and what the future might hold, those are the things that help me find a voice. And I think that over time that voice has become more original and more something that I own so that I don't have to say what everybody else is saying all the time. And I find then that I have things to say that maybe people haven't thought of before and people find valuable.
All right, let's go back to that pandemic getaway. You've gotten to know a whole new community. You bought a cottage last year because it is a perfect pandemic getaway. Tell me about it.
So that was not the reason. We bought it in October and we didn't foresee. We had all these plans about getting beds moved in and things that were completely derailed by the pandemic. But so we bought a cottage in a town called New Buffalo. New Buffalo is the very first city that's north of the border along the lake at the Indiana border. And it was historically actually, I didn't know this at the time, but called the Riviera of Chicago, because it's also the first really good beach town from Chicago. It's about an hour from there. We had been wanting to buy one, and we're thinking about up north, but we go to Chicago a lot, and we like to spend a lot of time in the Chicago area. And so we figured we would use it year-round, and when we go into Chicago to see plays or things like that, we would stop in New Buffalo. Then the pandemic happened. I got sick right in the beginning, and I still don't know if it was COVID, but I was sick for about a week, and I was quarantined for about 2 weeks. Then I worked from home for some time, but then once the order to not leave your community ended, we spent more time down in New Buffalo. The entire city population is about 1,900 people, and so it's a very different world than Grand Rapids. it reminds me a little bit of Holland when I was a child, because we moved to Holland when I was 8, and the population of Holland at that time was about 35,000, I think. It's even smaller than that. But we got to know our neighbors. We walk to get ice cream sometimes. We can walk to the beach. And it's been really fantastic. As we were walking in, we were talking about the weather, you and I, mm-hmm. and how nice the summer has been. And I feel like that has been the one thing that has been a sort of saving grace. The two things that have been a saving grace of COVID. One are that I'm quarantined with the person in the world that I would choose to be quarantined with. Mm-hmm. And so it has been good for Terry and I. And then the other thing has been just that the weather has been fantastic. And even when we can enjoy so many things, we try to enjoy the outdoors.
Talk about taking risks. There throws you a little 180 there. Do you take risks?
I try to. So, and I'm going to jump ahead, actually, but you had asked me earlier about mottos. And I'm a big lover of children's books. And one of my favorites growing up was The Chronicles of Narnia. Mm-hmm. In The Chronicles of Narnia, Lucy asks Mr. and Mrs. Beaver about Aslan, and she keeps asking them if Aslan is safe. And so Aslan is this giant lion that is sort of a Christ-like figure in the novels. And Mr. Beaver finally says, you haven't been listening. Of course he's not safe, but he's good. And so one of my goals in life is to be good but not safe. I don't always live up to it. I get drawn into safety too, but I think it's important to create situations where people can try new things. I left my original major in college with 108 credits because I wasn't sure it would make me happy. I left engineering with a master's degree and 5 years of experience because I wasn't sure it would make me happy. I tell a story about that camp that I mentioned where I couldn't swim in deep water. And one summer I got assigned to these two kids with asthma who all they wanted was a deep water swimming badge, and I had to go with them for them to get their bracelets. When the time finally came, we were, you know, rushed to get them out to the pool for swim time, and I suddenly realized that I had to do the test with them. And I thought, well, I'm in a swimming pool in a camp for special needs kids. There's a lifeguard on duty. The worst thing that could happen to me is embarrassment. And so I jumped in, and I don't know what it is about that, but I was about 30 at the time, and I overcame my fear of deep water, and I've, you know, been comfortable swimming. I'm not a very fast swimmer. I look up to you with your triathlons, but
meet me at the lake in an hour.
I know. I'm not a very fast swimmer, but I can hold my own. I can keep my head above the water. The water doesn't scare me like it did when I was a kid. And it was because I took that risk, because I followed their lead. And so I believe in taking risks. I went into private practice about 4 years ago, and that was a risk too. I had a really good experience with a large nonprofit in the area, Hope Network, and I just needed something different personally. And I took that risk. I didn't know what exactly would happen. You know, I didn't know whether it would be good financially or bad financially. I didn't know if I could cobble together things that were more like what I wanted to be doing, but it's been really positive. And I think life is all about taking risk. And as a parent, for the parents I work with, or as a person that sometimes people look up to, maybe what I really emphasize is, can we create systems where people can take risks within reason and have some protection so that we can do some of the things that in hindsight we tell you 5 years later, gosh, that was stupid. But I am a better person for having taken that risk and failed. Business people talk about fail fast, I think, in that same kind of topic. But I think that people should do that. And I hope that I don't get too safety loving as I get older.
I don't know. You almost took a risk on a Friday night. You almost got married Friday the 13th. What happened there?
That was kind of a joke. We have been engaged for 5 years before we got married in December. And we reached the point where it had gotten ridiculous and we hadn't planned a wedding for 5 years, and life was continuing to evolve. My private practice, Terry had taken on a new job with Fifth Third, and other things kept popping up in our lives. And so we finally said, the wedding is not the most important thing anymore. We have a big community of people who love us. We know that. And we just need to be married. And so finally what happened was we got together a couple of friends, and a friend who is a pastor kindly offered to officiate. And we were literally at the point where we wanted to get married before the end of the year last year. And we were looking for dates that worked. And it turned out that one person had an obligation on Friday the 13th. And so we went with Saturday morning instead.
Nice. Talk about inspiration. We can drop a name. You can talk about the importance of having someone in our lives that inspires us. Tell me about someone maybe that pushed you or inspired you.
Yeah. The thing I think that is the most important about this is I've really reflected over the last few years that it's important. I've always felt it's important to have role models, but I've really reflected more on the importance of having many role models, because I think that the reality is the world changes. Nobody is who we need to be in the future because they didn't live in the situations that we live in. And because I believe in authenticity, I also believe that nobody will ever be a better you than you. And so if you try to chase being somebody else, then you'll never be as good at being them as they were. And you're missing the opportunity to be something really special that you can be. Mm. But I have a lot of role models. I think, like a lot of people, my mother taught me a lot of early values about education, the value of being intellectually engaged. She was a risk taker, and both of my parents left a comfortable life in India to try to get better opportunities here and to create better opportunities for me. And they lost a lot of things along the way for my benefit, you know, the social position that they had in India and the benefits that came with social position in India, you know, coming to a new country where they didn't speak the language perfectly and they didn't understand all of the customs and they had to adapt. My father showed up in the Midwest in the winter to go to grad school without a winter coat. And in small ways like that, and in bigger ways, they had to adapt. And so my parents definitely, my mother definitely. But then I think that there's so many women in our community and also in communities I know outside of Grand Rapids. But I look to them and think, you know, who will I be in 5, 10, or 20 years, 5 years, you know, when I'm 50 or 60 or 80? They're my role models of staying intellectually engaged. When I see you post pictures of doing triathlons, it really is a role model because I need to get back to exercise, and it has been an important part of my life. But I look at women in my life who also are continuing to find their voice. And I was actually just on the phone with somebody on Sunday talking about this, a fellow psychologist from Atlanta. And we were talking about how I think one of the hidden advantages women have in society is that there are a lot of role models of women who get louder and more uninhibited in saying what they believe as they get older. My mother's one of those people who will talk who will tell you like it is. And I call her and my mother's very conservative, but I called her a few months ago and out of the blue, she said, "What really makes me angry is that these kids are getting beaten up in police encounters. They didn't do anything. They didn't deserve it." And I didn't expect to have this conversation with my mother at that time, but I agree with her that, you know, it's a real problem. And, I think that I have a lot of role models, particularly who, like the psychologist I was talking to, are people who have become more vocal as they get older. And to me, that's one of the best advantages of getting older.
Share a recommendation of a good book.
Well, I'll tell you what I'm reading right now. I'm a psychologist by training, but I'm interested in other sciences. I am reading or trying to read Thomas Piketty's new book, Capital and Ideology. It is really long. I'm listening to it mostly on audiobook, and it's 48 hours long. I'm about three quarters of the way through it. But I have really tried to educate myself about economics and how they play a role as a social determinant of health, is what doctors say sometimes. But understanding the ways that things other than medicine in the traditional sense impact people's wellness, along those lines, you know, thinking about those kids who get beat up for no good reason. There is an excellent book, an economics book that is much shorter called The Color of Money. It's by an author named Mirza Baradaran. And it talks about economic injustices that the African-American community has faced. And I think it's a real eye-opener for anyone who is not Black in America, including myself. And so that's the area that I've been trying to learn more about recently.
And I'm sure the Chronicles of Narnia somewhere is in the household.
Yeah. Yes, it's been propping up my my tablet when I've been on Zoom meetings, actually.
Thank you, Dr. Mira Jordan, for sharing a bit of your life, your good work, here on this edition of Powerful Women Let's Talk.
Thank you so much.
And thank you for listening. I'm Shelley Irwin.
Produced by women about women, these powerful podcasts focus on powerful women and how their strength transforms who we are and how we live. Want to hear more Powerful Women Let's Talk? Get additional interviews at WGVU.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Please rate and subscribe. Powerful Women Let's Talk is produced by WGVU at the Meyer Public Broadcast Center at Grand Valley State University. The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily reflect those of WGVU, its underwriters, or Grand Valley State University.